Chapter 4, High School. I started high school at the beginning of 1958, just a few months after federal troops were called out in Little Rock, Arkansas, to protect 9 black teenagers who enrolled in a previously segregated all-white high school. Berkeley might seem to be on the opposite end of the spectrum from Little Rock, and in many ways it was. But Berkeley was nonetheless still part of America, and the same issues would play themselves out, in different ways, in my high school years. I, of course, didn't understand it quite that way when I started high school. I was mostly just a 14-year-old kid trying to figure out where to fit in. Orientation. I remember two things from my first day at Berkeley High. First, my friend John and I had arranged that we would see each other. We were starting in February, so there was a one-week break at the end of January between junior high and high school. We'd agreed that the first day of school we'd hook up and kind of go through the experience together and continue to be tight as friends. But then when I got there, I looked all around for him, and he wasn't there. He wasn't there all that week or the next month. And then I found out he'd been busted and been sent to juvenile hall. So that was kind of a jolt for me. The second thing I remember is the orientation assembly for all the kids who'd just come into the 10th grade. The school was a 3-year school, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades. The February group was a smaller class than the one that started in September, but they still had a program for all the new kids who'd come from the 3 junior highs, Willard, Burbank, and Garfield. This was the first time we all got thrown together this way. I was walking around trying to find a place to sit because I got there a little late, and a lot of the seats were taken. There was this one black kid who was leaning against the wall with his feet sticking out a little bit, just looking around. As I went by him, I very consciously made a point of walking around him so I wouldn't bump into him or anything, because I was uptight. Everybody in my junior high had always buzzed about how this was a big deal when you went to Berkeley High, and how you were going to have to deal with all this stuff, and maybe get in fights. So I was stepping very carefully. As I walked all the way around him, all of a sudden he turns toward me and says, "Hey man, you stepped on my dogs." "No, I didn't." "Yeah, you did, man. You stepped on my dogs." Now, by the time I was a senior in high school, this guy, whose name was Odell, was part of a singing group that I was also part of. This was how things went through changes. On that first day, though, he was just messing with me as part of the general thing that was going on. So that was my orientation. I don't remember anything the principal or teacher said, but I remember Odell. My earlier experiences didn't really count for much in this setting. Even though John had been my best friend in junior high school, he wasn't there, and in any case, that was a somewhat more limited experience. Although he went to the same school I did, he lived in a different part of town. We didn't go to each other's houses. Outside of school, our contact was just mainly on the phone. And my earlier experience at YMCA camp was as a younger kid. This was a big change. All of a sudden you were going to a school that was about half black, and there was a lot of cohesion among the black students as well. So they had a big influence. Plus there was a lot going on in the world. Things were changing. Black people were becoming much more self-assertive, proud of being black, and not putting up with any shit anymore. As I said, there were battles about desegregating the schools beginning to go on all over the country at that time, even in Berkeley, where the schools had been segregated. During the time I was in high school, my father got on the school board and was playing a leading role in the fight to desegregate the schools. So this was the larger context at that time, and this definitely had an effect where I was. I was quite nervous. I didn't react in the way I know some of the kids from Garfield did, with pretty traditional, straight-up racist kind of garbage. But I was still very uptight about the whole thing, because I didn't know what was going to happen. You don't know how lucky you are. Now, I learned to love this very quickly. But when you're first stepping into it, it's like, whoa. Especially in my second semester in high school, though, because that was football season, I started having closer interconnections and relations with people of all different races or nationalities, including a lot of black people. But some things happened even in my first semester that started taking me down a certain path, you might say. I'd already started to make friends with people that I knew were going to be on the football team, including people who'd gone to Burbank or Willard that I'd played against in sports. We were now in gym class together, All the guys who played a sport were put in the same gym classes. And so we started to break down some of these barriers. I got to know and started becoming friends with Langston Tabor, with whom I'd been in these shoving matches and near fights during that basketball game at Burbank. One day when our gym class instruction was in swimming, I was at the edge of the pool and Langston was just kind of hanging out nearby. All of a sudden, I looked up and there was this guy kind of looming over me. He looked down at me and said, "Is your name Bob Avakian?" And I answered, "Yeah." He went on, "Did you go to Garfield?" "Yeah." Next he asked, "Did you play basketball for Garfield? Did you play against Burbank?" Again I said, "Yeah." And now I'm trying to figure out where all this is going. And then came the punchline. "Did you foul me?" Now I really didn't know what was going on, but I just gave him a straightforward answer because I was sort of naive. I said, "I might have. I can't remember something like that." So then this big grin came over his face, almost like a leer or a smirk. He just kept that look for what seemed like minutes to me, but was probably only 10 or 15 seconds. Then he slowly turned and walked away. I was still trying to figure out what the hell was going on, and Langston comes up and says, "Man, you don't know how lucky you are. That's Jack McRae. He's one of the baddest dudes in the whole school." I said, "Yeah?" And Langston went on, "He was getting ready to fire on you. He was going to punch you out." I said, "What are you talking about, man? He was smiling." Langston laughed. "Yeah, but when he gets that smile on his face, that's when he's getting ready to unload on somebody." This made a big impression on me. I learned about Jack McRae a little more in high school and after high school. I even played basketball against him again at a rec center in Southwest Berkeley. It was all cool. I believe he's still sort of a legendary figure in the Sacramento Street section of Berkeley. But this was a very dramatic experience for me. And afterward, Langston kind of joked around with me about it and schooled me in how I might handle this kind of situation better. But he was getting a good laugh out of the fact that, probably to Jack, I just seemed so out of it that he decided, "I'll just let this white boy slide." There were a lot of encounters like this. It wasn't just me. This was a time when black people were fighting for justice and equality in the civil rights movement, and more generally. Even in their personal interactions with people, they were asserting themselves more. This was going on all throughout the school and in the larger society. As part of this, there was a lot of testing to see how you were going to react, to see what kind of person you are. Segregation within integration. While Berkeley High was integrated, in the sense that kids from all over the city went there, within the school it was very segregated. There was tracking and the classes were largely segregated. Not entirely, but to a large degree. The lunchroom was very segregated, and there would tend to be segregation even within the gym classes, where black and white students were mixed together. Generally, people did not hang out together socially, and things were segregated on that level too. As I started to make more friends among the black kids in school and to hang out with them, many of my white friends, or former friends, were not accepting of that. Not only were things still pretty segregated within the school was very stratified and very cliquish. Among the white students, you had these social clubs, which were basically junior versions of sororities and fraternities. The clubs were exclusively white, with the exception of one black female social club, and they were completely segregated. There were no integrated social clubs. Except for the black sorority, they were preserves of privilege and bastions of segregation in the school. They exerted a lot of influence, and they were generally hated by everyone who wasn't in them. The black kids especially, with very good reason, hated these social clubs. And a number of kids I had known in junior high, including some of my friends, joined these social clubs. I wasn't into that. I was making friends with all kinds of kids, including a lot of black kids. And the general attitude coming from the white kids that I had known in junior high was, "What are you doing?" In fact, there was one guy from junior high named Gary who came up to me and said, "I want to ask you something." I looked at him as if to say, "Yeah." Then he blurted out, "Why don't you stick with your own kind?" I looked him in the face and said, "You mean like you?" And that was the end of that conversation and of any friendship between us. I don't think that making new friends, especially with black kids, was any kind of conscious statement or anything like that. I didn't really think about it in what you might call social or political terms, except in situations like the time this guy Gary challenged me in this straight-up racist way. More, it was a matter of what I wanted to do. I started making friends with people I liked, and that was it. I hung out with a lot of different groups of people. For a couple of semesters, I regularly sat with this group of Japanese-American kids, mainly girls, during lunch, and they would talk about things that I hadn't really had much experience with or understanding of before that. I really liked them. They were very interesting, very intellectual, but they weren't snobbish or stuck up. Then there was my friend Keo, who was a white kid that I'd known ever since grammar school, even though he didn't go to the same grammar school as me. He was a real sports nut like me, but he also had a lot of other things going on. He was a couple of years ahead of me in school. I think he was only there for one semester when I was at Berkeley High, and then he graduated. But we often ate lunch together during that one semester. One day during school, he didn't show up for lunch, which was unusual. So after school, that evening, I called him up to ask him where he'd been. He said, "First fucking day of the fucking baseball season." The Giants had just moved from New York to San Francisco. I said, "Oh, really? You went to the game? Fucking A, man. Great game. Fucking great game." I asked what was so great about it. "Fucking Willie Mays. Unfucking believable. First fucking pitch. Fucking line drive over the fucking fence. Fucking home run. Unfucking believable." I said, "Kale, do you realize how many times you said fuck in the last 10 seconds? "No. How many?" I said, "Probably about a dozen." "Oh, fuck." I remember one day at lunch, he came in and he had this little drawing on a piece of paper. And I asked, "What's that?" He said, "You know, I've been thinking about infinity." I said, "Really? What about infinity?" "Yeah," he says, "see, I don't really think it's boundless in space, but I think it kind of winds back on itself." And he had this piece of paper with a drawing on it, one of those things where it would wind back on itself, like a Mobius strip or something like that. He said, "This is how I think infinity is." So then we started discussing infinity. This was completely out of nowhere, but he'd been thinking about infinity. On the one hand, he'd take off from school to go to the baseball game. Then another day, he comes in talking about infinity, with this diagram to illustrate how he thought infinity was. From the time I was 13, his family, Keo, his two brothers, and his father, would go to track meets with me and my dad. As I said, we used to really love this sprinter at Cal, Lehman King. He was a world-class sprinter, but he was one of these guys who didn't like to practice. He'd run down the track a few times in these old gym shoes, practice a few starts, and that was it. We'd go to the Cal track where he was practicing, and we'd talk to him, ask him how he felt about the upcoming meets and things like that. They used to have this track meet called the West Coast Relays in Fresno every spring. We would get in our car, Keo's family and my family, or at least my dad and his brothers, Keo and me. We'd all pile in and go down to Fresno. We'd go to watch Lehman King run, and sometimes we had banners on our car saying things like, "Lehman, King of Fresno." Clarence, Lonnie, and Larger Forces. I remember these two black guys named Clarence and Lonnie. They were known by everybody in the school, I mean black, white, whatever, as being the kind of guys who were always causing shit. For example, when you would come out of the showers in gym class, they'd stand there and snap people with their towels, especially all the white guys, and they had this whole routine they did. One day I came out of the shower, and one of them snapped me in the butt with a towel. So I went up to Clarence and I said, "Hey Clarence, man, why'd you snap me in the butt with a towel?" He insisted, "That wasn't me, man, that was Lonnie." Then I go up to Lonnie and I say, "Lonnie, why'd you snap me in the butt with a towel, man?" "That wasn't me, man, that was Clarence." So they had this whole Lonnie and Clarence routine they did all the time. I think even there it had a little bit of a social meaning to it, reflecting what was going on in society on a larger scale. They didn't just snap everybody's butt. It was mainly the white guys. Now we had an open campus where you could go out at lunchtime and get snacks or go up to the stores a few blocks away, and there was one main street where people walked up and down and hung out. One day some guys from the football team, who were also part of this whole social club scene, were walking down the street. And on the other side of the street were Clarence and Lonnie and some of their friends. And either Clarence or Lonnie threw an ice cream cone and hit this white guy named John in the face. John was wearing his social club jacket, so he was like a walking provocation. John crossed the street with some of his friends and went up to Clarence and said, "Clarence, was that you that threw that ice cream cone at me?" And Clarence said, "No, man, that wasn't me, that was Lonnie." So then John says, Lonnie, you threw that ice cream cone at me? And Lonnie says, no, man, fuck you, and then starts yelling at him. Then Clarence starts pretending he's going to restrain Lonnie. Oh, come on, man. And all of a sudden, he wheels and punches John in the face. The whole street immediately broke out into these opposing lines, fighting up and down the street, blacks against whites, as if it were choreographed. I was hanging out with some kids, black and white, and we didn't get into it. But the fight went on for a while. It became a big deal in the school, and we all got the usual lectures about it. The football team got lectures about how we all hang together and blah, 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 as if there were no racism even in the football team. A few days later, when I came out of gym at the end of the school day, there was this long line of black guys who'd come from different schools around Oakland, as well as our school, and they'd formed a kind of gauntlet. The reason I know they were from different schools is that I came out of gym with a couple of friends of mine, and they knew some of these guys. They had family connections or just social connections, and they told me, that guy is from McClyman's, that guy is from Castlemont, and so on. So I'm walking out and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. Because every white guy coming out there in the aftermath of this fight is getting kicked and punched. I didn't particularly want to get kicked or punched. And as I'm getting ready to enter into this gauntlet, I see two or three guys that I know. So I said, hey, so-and-so, how's it going? And I held my breath and started walking. They nodded at me or said something back, and I managed to make it all the way through the gauntlet without being kicked and punched. Then I noticed once I was through, there were some other guys who came behind me, and the kicking and punching started again. But this was bigger than anything having to do with me. This was coming from the larger contradictions of society and the larger racist relations and racist ideas that were being challenged. And this was breaking out in a lot of ways. I mean, Lonnie and Clarence weren't politically conscious activists, and they had their own particular characters and things they did. But even though you could say that Lonnie and Clarence started it by throwing the ice cream cone, this whole social club thing was a standing, and in this case a walking, provocation. These guys wearing their social club jackets going down the street were making a statement, and people resented this for good reason. That was the provocation that led to this. People have these idealist visions of Berkeley as some place that's always been the way it became through the 60s. But there was a lot of open segregation and overt racism in Berkeley at that time. A couple of years after I left Berkeley High, in the early 60s, a really ugly racist incident took place. There was this area called the Slope where people would eat lunch outside. There were certain areas where the white kids ate and black kids better not come over and eat there or there'd be a fight. If you were a white kid, you could go eat where the black kids were, and some of us did. But if you were black, you did not go in these other areas. Finally, this came to a very overt and very ugly head during my younger sister's senior year. One night, some white kid from the South named Jeff and some of his friends drew a line on the slope and wrote on it, Mason-Dixon line. When the segregationist content became overt like that, fights broke out in the school and then the lines were very clear. But things were beginning to change, and this guy Jeff and his friends were more isolated than they would have been even when I was in high school. I remember my friend Billy, who I'll talk about later, and who was in the same class as my sister. Billy put out the word when this happened that he was looking for this kid Jeff. And Jeff didn't show up at school for some time after this. But even in this earlier incident with Lonnie and Clarence, though it didn't have the same overt, clear-cut social content, we sensed and knew that this had something to do with these larger things going on in society. To one degree or another, many people, including myself, understood that, even if we didn't feel like getting into this particular fight. And that was true for some black friends of mine who also didn't feel like getting into it, because it was kind of like, ah, oh, man, that's Lonnie and Clarence. Yet everybody understood it was a bigger thing at the same time. Basketball, football, and larger forces. At that time, the basketball coach at Berkeley High, Sid Scott, was a Christian fundamentalist. He was always lecturing the players about religion. He was also a big racist. Every year when I was in high school, and even before I got there, the starting team would always be three black players and two white. My friends and I used to always talk and argue about why this was. Because while sometimes there were white guys who should have been on the starting five, a lot of times you could easily see there were five black players who should have started, or at least four. I thought that this coach's thinking went along the lines that if he had four black players and one white on the floor, the four black players would freeze out the white guy, so then they wouldn't all play together. even though, of course, this was ridiculous. And if he had 5 black guys out there, he figured all the discipline on the team would break, and it would just be an undisciplined mess. Also ridiculous. And he couldn't have less than 3 black players because it was so outrageous, given who was on the team and how good different players were. This is how I used to analyze this. But when I would discuss this with a lot of my black friends, including ones on the basketball team, they would explain to me very patiently, "Look, man, it's not just Sid Scott. It's the alumni and all that kind of shit from the school. People who have more authority around the school. They don't want an all-black team out there. So this coach, yeah, he's a racist dog and all that, but it's not just him." And then I would argue, "No, it's him. He's a racist dog." And of course, they were much more right than I was. My friends and I would go to each other's houses, stay overnight at each other's houses, and we'd talk about this kind of stuff all the time. Especially the more the civil rights movement was picking up, and the more this carried over into all kinds of ways in which people were saying what had been on their minds for a long time, but were now expressing much more openly and assertively. One time when I was a senior in high school, our school got to play a night football game. Now, we didn't get to play many night games. They would always be afraid there'd be a riot at the game because of the nature of our student body. I think this was the only night game we ever played. We went on a bus trip to Vallejo, which is maybe 20-25 miles from Berkeley, and the bus ride took about an hour. During that time and on the way back after the game, I was sitting with some black friends of mine on the football team, and we got into this whole deep conversation about why there is so much racism in this country, why there is so much prejudice, and where does it come from, and can it ever change, and how could it change? This was mainly them talking and me listening. And I remember that very, very deeply. I learned a lot more in that 1 hour than I learned in hours of classroom time, even from some of the better teachers. Things like that discussion went on all the time on one level or another. But this bus ride was kind of a concentrated opportunity to get into all this. A lot of times when we were riding to games, we just talk about bullshit the way kids do. But sometimes it would get into heavy things like this. And there was something about this being a special occasion, this night game. We were traveling through the dark, and somehow this lent itself to more serious conversation. Dating and larger forces. I was not part of the social life that a lot of people with whom I'd gone to junior high were part of. There were girls who actually liked me, but they would say things like, "You know, I like you, but I can't go out with you because you hang around with all these black people," and things like that. And that instantly made me not want to go out with them anyway. There were things that were explicitly said like that. And then sometimes you could just tell the deal by the way people acted. And all this was being shaped by the larger things going on in society and the world. Whom you were even attracted to, and whom you were interested in going out with. Whom you were interested in as a girlfriend, and whom you wanted to be friends with. This was being shaped or heavily influenced by these larger things going on. There were taboos. You didn't date interracially. You didn't do that. There were a few kids in my class who did, and they took a lot of shit for it. In my senior year, there was one girl that I was very fond of, who was in glee club with me, and we went out for a little while. She was actually the head of the one black social club in the school. Now, it was a rule that every social club had to invite at least the president of every other social club to whatever function they had. So she was invited to a New Year's Eve dance sponsored by one of these white social clubs, and she asked me to be her date for that. I said, sure, because we liked each other. So we went, along with another couple, 2 black friends of hers. Of course, there's this whole tradition that on New Year's Eve, you give your date a big kiss when it strikes midnight. So at the dance, there was all this tension, because we were there and we were dancing together the whole night and hanging out together, just like any other couple would. Except, I could tell as it got to be 11:15, closer and closer to midnight, this palpable tension was in the air. What's going to happen when midnight comes? When midnight came, she and I gave each other the biggest imaginable kiss, both because we really liked each other, but also really wanted to make these people eat it. So we had a great time doing that. But it was a big deal. The tension there was very real. Of course, I got called things like nigger lover, and I didn't get invited to join these social clubs, which was nothing because I wouldn't have wanted to do that anyway. But whatever ways in which I was ostracized and outcast among the mainstream whites was really nothing compared to what my black friends went through. From the time I was a junior in high school, there were four of us who hung out together. Matthew, Joel, Hemby, and me. Two of us white, two of us black. We were always hanging out together. One time Matthew, who was black, really had a crush on this one white girl. He wanted to ask her out, and finally he worked up his courage and asked her out. And she told him, "Well, you know, I'd like to go out with you, but my parents and my friends and all this kind of shit." That was much more painful than anything that happened to me. It was very painful for me being his friend, and it was the kind of thing that I know left a deep scar in Matthew. It was just horrible and excruciating, and the scars of that were much deeper than anything that happened to me. Street Corner Symphonies. I had this friend, Sam. Actually, I knew him before high school because I went to a church in Berkeley where his father worked as the custodian, and he would come around and help his father sometimes. Then when I went to high school, he was a little bit ahead of me, but we became friends, and then we became part of a singing group. Sam had this one characteristic. When he was eating, he didn't want anybody to say anything to him. It was just leave him alone and let him eat. I don't care who it was or what the circumstances were. That was just Sam. You just knew you should stay away from him then, because he didn't want to talk. He wanted to eat. So one day I had forgotten to bring my lunch money, and I was really hungry by lunch. I couldn't pay for anything in the cafeteria or the snack shack or anything. I was walking all around looking for some friend to loan me some money. So first I went over to Sam, and I knew that I was violating his big rule, but I couldn't help it. I went over and I said, "Sam, leave me alone, man, leave me alone." I said, "Sam, I'm really hungry. Leave me alone, I'm eating lunch." So I just finally gave up there. But I started walking all around looking for someone to loan me some money or give me something to eat or something. Finally, I saw this guy who had a plate full of food. What particularly stuck out to me was that he had two pieces of cornbread on his tray. And that just seemed so unfair because I was so hungry and he had not one, but two pieces of cornbread. I just sat down at the table across from him and stared for a long time at his plate. He kept looking at me like, "What's this motherfucker staring at me for?" I just kept staring at his tray. And finally I said, "Hey man, can I have one of your pieces of cornbread?" "No man, get the fuck out of here." I said, "Please man, I'm really hungry. I forgot my lunch money. Can I please have a piece of cornbread?" "No man, get the fuck out of here." I don't know what came over me. Maybe it was just the hunger. But without thinking, I reached over and grabbed one of the pieces of cornbread. He kicked his chair back, jumped up, and got ready to fight. So I didn't have any choice. I jumped up too. He stared at me for a long time. A long time. And then he finally said, "Aw, man, go ahead." So I took the piece of cornbread. Then after that, Sam, who had looked up from his eating long enough to see all this, came over to me. Again, it was one of those things. And he said, "Man, that was Leo Wofford. You don't know what you just got away with." But I was so hungry, and I guess Leo figured, "Oh, this crazy white boy, he must really be hungry." So he just let it go. Sam lived in East Oakland, but he went to school in Berkeley. A few times I went out to his house. He lived right where East Oakland abutted against San Leandro, and it was like in the South. There was this creek and a fence right outside of 98th Avenue in East Oakland, and if you were black, you did not go on the other side of the fence into San Leandro, or these racist mobs would come after you. Sam lived right at the border there. A few times Sam took me to places and events out in East Oakland. One time we went to this housing project, which was kind of laid out in concentric circles, with a row of apartments arranged in a circle, and then another circle inside that, and then another one. And at the very center was a playground, where there was a basketball court. When we got there, there were some guys getting ready to play ball. I recognized a couple of them who ran track for Castlemont High. So I went over and got in the game. Well, at a certain point, one of these track guys and I got into a face-off. We'd been guarding each other and sometimes bumping and pushing each other, and then it just about got to the point of a fight. Everybody else stood back and gave us room. But after we stared at each other for a while, it didn't go any further, and we just got back to the game. But as this was happening, I noticed that Sam, who had been watching at the edge of the court, was turning and walking away. Another time, Sam and I went to a basketball game between Castlemont and Berkeley High. The game was at Castlemont, but I didn't have any sense, so I kept yelling shit at the Castlemont players. Their star player was a guy named Fred Sweetie Davis, and at one point he got knocked to the floor by a guy on our team. So I stood up and yelled, "How does it feel to be the one on the floor, Sweetie?" Sam had been trying to get me to stop acting the fool and shut up. And when this happened, he just got up and walked away like, "I don't know this crazy white boy." So sometimes, without meaning to, I put Sam in some very difficult situations. Sam was a really good singer. So one day I went to him and I asked, "Hey, Sam, you want to start up a group?" He thought about it for a while and then he got back to me and said, "Yeah, let's do it." Sam had a cousin named George who played piano, and George could also sing. So Sam said, "Let's get George in the group." And there was this other guy, Felton, who was one of the few black kids who had gone to junior high school where I did. So I went and asked him if he wanted to be part of it, and Felton said, "Yeah." Then I asked Randy, this white kid who'd been part of this impromptu singing group with John and me in our last year in junior high school. So the five of us, three black, two white, formed a group. We figured out pretty quickly that Sam should sing lead, at least on most of the songs, and then the others of us took our parts. You have to have a bass, and that was Felton. We had to have a baritone, and that was Randy. Then you had to have a second tenor, which was a lower range tenor, and that was George. And the first tenor was me. We had this whole thing worked out. Sometimes we practiced at George's house because he had a piano in his house, and sometimes we'd go to my house because we also had a piano. We'd spend 3 or 4 hours a lot of days just practicing, working on our music. And we'd sing anywhere we could get together to sing. This was part of a whole thing where people would get together, sometimes in formal groups, and sometimes just with whoever was around at the time, and sing everywhere. In the locker rooms before and after gym class, in the hallways and stairways at school, and out on the street corners. Eventually, Randy left the group, and then Odell. Odell, who'd claimed I'd stepped on his dogs way back on our first day of school, replaced him. When Odell replaced Randy, I reminded him of that run-in we'd had, and he didn't even remember it, but he got a big laugh out of my telling the story. Odell used to write songs. I'd see him out in the hallway. "Hey, Odell, what are you doing? How come you're not in class?" "I'm writing some songs, man." We'd practice and we'd try to get gigs, wanting to get paid and get known a little bit. We had to come up with a name for the group. There was already the Cadillacs and the Impalas, so we became the Continentals. Now, we'd also been rehearsing at the rec center at Live Oak, because they had a piano in there. The director of the rec center heard us and said, "Hey, I like your sound. Would you guys be willing to play for this dance we're having?" We answered, "Yeah, are you going to pay us?" And he said, "Well, we have a tight budget, but I could pay you something." So then we all got together and said, "How about $100? He came back with, "How about 25? We looked at each other and said, "Okay," because any money was good then. We rehearsed a lot for this, and we came there that night ready to do this heartbeat song, "You're 1,000 Miles Away," and some other tunes. As we were about to go in the rec center, this friend of Sam's who'd been playing basketball was coming over to get a drink of water. He said, "Sam, what are you doing here?" Sam said, "We're going to sing for this dance." "You can't sing, Sam." "Yeah, I can, man." So before we could go in to perform for the dance, we had to have a sing-off between Sam and his friend. They both did a spaniel song, and after a couple of verses, the other guy threw in the towel, because Sam could really sing. Another time, my younger sister got us a gig performing at their ninth grade dance. The other guys in the group said, "Okay, man, this is your sister's thing." So they let me sing lead on one song. I think it was called "Oh Happy Day." And that was a lot of fun. Some of the white parents just didn't relate to this music at all. And with some, there was a whole racist element in it, because it was the influence of black culture working its way into the mainstream. But a lot of the white youth were taking it up and were really into it, as exemplified by my older sister's junior high school class voting WPLJ as their favorite song. I think Richard Pryor made this point in one of his routines. When it's just black people doing something, then maybe they can contain it. But when it starts spilling over among the white youth, then, oh dear, everything's getting out of control. So there was that sort of shit, and there was a general thing among the racist and backward white kids, where listening to this music and getting into this culture was part of a whole package of things you didn't do. They would give you shit for that, but it was just a part of a whole package of everything they were down on, and all the things they'd give you shit for. Besides singing doo-wop, I was in the glee club in school. When I was a senior, the glee club teacher talked me and three other guys, two of us black, two of us white, into doing a barbershop quartet song for the talent show. And we did it, with our own little touch to it. Another time when I was 16 or 17, I went to a Giants baseball game. Right before the game starts, they always have the national anthem, and I was still somewhat patriotic. I wasn't super patriotic, but I still thought this was a good country overall, even though I was very angry about discrimination and segregation and racism and all that. So we all stood up for the anthem, and for whatever reason, I started singing along. The song finished, and this woman in front of me turned around and said, "You know, you have a beautiful voice." I've often thought back on the irony of that. But it wasn't very long before I quit singing that. Later, when I would go to ball games and they would play the national anthem, I would stand up and sing, as loudly as I could, a version that someone I knew had made up. "Oh, Uncle Sam, get out of Vietnam. Get out, get out, get out of Vietnam." Family clashes. We had these Armenian relatives in L.A. They were relatives of my father, but they were very unlike my father. They were very provincial, very snobbish, very big supporters of Billy Graham, and big-time racists. One time, my younger sister Mary Lou and I were staying in their house, and we got in an argument about all this kind of stuff. My dad's uncle, ironically his name was Sam, and we called him Uncle Sam, started this argument, and at one point he said to me, "Well, Bobby, what would you say about it, and how would you feel if your younger sister Mary Lou started dating a Negro, or even married a Negro?" And I answered, "Well, that's up to her. If she wants to do that, it's fine with me." So then we got into a big roaring argument. And here you see not only the racism, but also the patriarchy. He didn't ask her how she'd feel about it, and she was sitting right there. But it was as if she were invisible. Within our broader family circles, there was a lot of that kind of shit. As I mentioned earlier, Fresno was very segregated at that time. A lot of backward reactionary stuff was concentrated there. And my relatives were, again, sort of narrow provincial into a lot of this backward reactionary and racist stuff. When I was maybe 18 or 19, we were visiting down there on one of the holidays, and they asked me to do a dramatic reading of something that was being circulated in their circles. I didn't know what it was, so I agreed. When I started reading it, it turned out to be this racist parody about John Kennedy's son marrying Martin Luther King's daughter. All this racist garbage. When I realized what they were having me read, I just stopped and I got furious. And they must have regretted ever having given this to me to read. Because I just launched into a tirade against them and their segregated Fresno. "You don't know anything about black people. You refuse to go anywhere where they are. You avoid them. You with your freeway through the middle of town and all the segregation," and so on. I don't even remember everything I said, but it went on for about 5 minutes, and they all just sat there, frozen. Then I just threw the thing down and stalked out of the room, and it became, of course, a big episode in family relations. But they deserved it, and I didn't feel the least bit sorry about it. Now, I do have to say that when I was in high school, I drove to Fresno with some friends of mine, black and white, to go to the West Coast Relays. And my Auntie Bit and Uncle Beecher put us up in their house and were very warm and welcoming. Given the general atmosphere they were part of, that spoke to how they were very kind and generous people on a personal level. Still, the racism among my relatives in Fresno was very pervasive. Actually, while my dad and mom were quite different from this, they were liberals, they were at the time sort of typical liberals. They were against discrimination, segregation, and racism, especially in any kind of overt form. But at the time, they weren't completely free of some of the more subtle forms of this. I remember, for example, that in the same general time frame as that incident when we were visiting in Fresno, this was in the early 60s, A discussion came up when my parents, myself, and my younger sister Mary Lou were on a trip. My friend Matthew had started flirting with Mary Lou, writing her poems, calling her up and talking with her on the phone and all that. I wasn't sure how much this was a situation where he was actually infatuated with my sister, and how much it was a matter of his testing us, testing me and testing my parents, to see what we would do. I think it was probably a little of both. Anyway, somehow this led to a discussion during this trip about interracial dating and marriage, and I was surprised and frankly shocked to hear my parents bringing up all the difficulties that would be involved in this, emphasizing this especially to my sister. After listening to this for a while, I got involved and things got pretty heated. Finally, I had had enough, and I told my parents in no uncertain terms, "I can't believe what I'm hearing. If you don't say that you wouldn't have a problem with Mary Lou going out with or marrying somebody black, then I'm leaving this family right now." Well, that kind of brought the argument to a crashing end. A kind of irony in all this is that some years later, my sister did marry somebody black, her boyfriend from high school, Buddy. And by that time, in the late 60s, my parents had gone through a lot of changes and genuinely welcomed Buddy into the family. Plato in the Park. To the degree that I was ever a jock, I kind of grew out of it because of a lot of different influences that had to do with the nature of the city I grew up in. I never grew out of being a sports fanatic, but you can be a sports fanatic without being a jock. A lot of the kids I knew who played sports in high school were also into other things. Some of them came from more academic or intellectual families, but also the people I was close with during my junior and senior years in high school, me, Matthew, Hemby, Joel, and some others, used to read Plato and Aristotle, John Stuart Mill and Shakespeare, and things like that. If we were hanging out having a hamburger, or if we'd be on the playground during a break between games, we'd start talking about all these different things we were reading, and we'd have debates. Some guys would make fun of us, but some others would join in. I remember having this one discussion with several people, and there was this question, I think it might have come from Descartes, about how God could draw a triangle without using a pencil. I said, "How can that be? How can he draw a triangle without using any kind of an instrument?" And my friend Matthew said, "Just by saying, there's a triangle." That was like one little sliver of the kind of conversations we had. It wasn't necessarily about God most of the time. Sometimes it was about John Stuart Mill's views on liberty, or John Locke and the rights of individuals, and how the different rights of individuals conflicted with each other, or about democracy. And of course, we talked about slavery, too. Before I got to a certain point in high school, I did my schoolwork, and I read what I was assigned to read, but that was it. Then all of a sudden, when I was 16 or so, I became really fascinated with all this discussion and wrangling over different ideas. This kind of thing may have been going on in other places, but I suspect it was more of a phenomenon in Berkeley because of the particular and almost peculiar mix of Berkeley. You have people coming out of the ghetto, and you have a lot of people who are related to the university. Like I said, even a reactionary asshole like Edward Tellerson was in one of my classes. We got into a debate where he was justifying the hydrogen bomb. So you had all these different kinds of things. My friend Matthew actually lived in Oakland, but he wanted to go to Berkeley High. He was a great athlete, and so they wanted him at the school, but he also wanted to go there because he and his parents thought it was better academically. So he came to our school, and he was very interested in and fascinated by all these big debates. It wasn't just the kids whose parents were professors or something. Matthew's father was a longshoreman, and his mother worked as a domestic worker. So it was a unique kind of mix. Matthew was a really good football player, and one day he called me up. "Guess where I am?" "Where?" "At the Air Force Academy." I exclaimed, "What the fuck are you doing at the Air Force Academy?" He said, "I'm thinking about going here. They're trying to recruit me." All I could say right then was something like, "Oh, fuck," because I'd grown up hating the military and all that kind of military discipline. So I really went after him when he got back. I said, "You want to eat meals where every bite you got to lift it up and make a square before it gets to your mouth? And you want to march in formation all over the fucking place?" I just kept after him and after him until finally he said, "Okay, man, okay. I won't go to the Air Force Academy." Spring thaw. There was a guy in my Spanish class named David who knew all these obscure facts about all these great literary figures from Latin America and Spain. I was tremendously impressed by this guy, but he wasn't really a friend of mine. He kept to himself a lot. But he seemed to be really very cosmopolitan, sort of a Renaissance man, and when you could draw him out in a conversation, which wasn't so easy to do, he was fascinating. David was part of a big thing in 1960. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, was going around the country with their anti-communist crusade, and they came to San Francisco. Before then, there had been people who had testified before HUAC who had been defiant. But now a lot of people, more than 1,000, I believe, demonstrated against HUAC in San Francisco. This was a massive outpouring, the first time that people stood up against HUAC in a mass public way. I was an aspiring poet, and that day I'd gone off to a conference of high school poets around Northern California. But I'd gotten back in time for Spanish class, and I'd noticed that David wasn't there. So the next day I asked him where he'd been. He explained that he was at the demonstration against HUAC. He and a number of other kids from my school who went to the demonstration talked about how they'd been attacked by the police, how fire hoses were used to drive them down the steps of the courthouse, and how it was a big outrage. It became a big deal politically in the society as a whole, and they were all very proud that they'd been part of this. I was really envious of them. I felt like I'd really missed out on something important, and I asked them a lot of questions about it. So it was kind of a spring thaw. A lot of things were busting loose. A lot of intellectual and cultural ferment was going on. The Beats were breaking out. They had started up in Greenwich Village in Manhattan and had come to North Beach in San Francisco. I remember William Buckley came to debate some liberal about the First Amendment, loyalty oaths, and all that kind of stuff. And Buckley started these disgusting antics to distract the audience while the liberal was talking. At the time, I was, of course, still strongly opposed to communism and accepted all the conventional wisdom, or unwisdom, about communism and how horrible it was. I remember asking David, "Well, are you a communist?" after he told me about the HUAC demonstration. He said, "No, but I hate HUAC," and then he explained why he hated it and everything it stood for. So this was a very exciting time. A lot of the girls I knew were influencing me at the time, including the Japanese-American girls that I ate lunch with, who were interested in a lot of different artistic and intellectual questions. Just as a side point, I remember one of them telling a story about Marlon Brando. She was talking about her grandmother, who had come from Japan and lived with their family and spoke no English, was watching a movie about Japan. Brando was in it, and at one point he spoke Japanese. And this girl told me that her grandmother said that if she closed her eyes when Brando was speaking, she couldn't tell he wasn't Japanese. For some reason, that story stuck with me. I later came to really like Marlon Brando, for a lot of other reasons, and actually met him at the time of a rally in support of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. There were other girls I knew from my classes who had an impact on me. One of them even said something to me to the effect of, "You know, when you were in junior high school, you were a real jerk. But now you're a much better person." So there was a kind of mutual or reciprocal thing there where we influenced each other. They played an important part in getting me interested in poetry, in philosophy, and a lot of the general intellectual ferment that was going on. Of course, it wasn't only girls. This kind of ferment was going on pretty broadly among a number of my friends and people I knew, both boys and girls. But it was significant and kind of a new thing for me that I developed close relationships with a number of girls. Not as girlfriends, but just as friends who happened to be girls. And that was also a lesson for me, because I had had more of a traditional view of girlfriends before then, and I really didn't have very many friends who were girls. I remember a few teachers very fondly from that time. Ms. Bentley was an English teacher who had us read a lot of Shakespeare, and I remember one time I deliberately set out to write a paper about Macbeth to prove a thesis that I actually didn't believe. For some reason, I just thought it would be fun and provocative to do this, but she got so furious at me that she wrote on the bottom of the paper, "You have too good a mind to be an intellectual ambulance chaser." I was really angry with her at the time, but she had a point. She didn't want to see whatever abilities I was developing misused for what she saw as paltry purposes. But she encouraged me to write, as well as opening me up to reading a lot of different things and seeing the value of that. I also learned a lot from Ms. Rodriguez, my senior year history teacher. Later on, she quit teaching, and after I heard about this, I wrote her a letter trying to argue with her to stay on because she was such a good teacher. She left anyway, but people like her had an influence on me, broadening my vistas about a lot of things. On the other hand, when I was either a sophomore or junior, we had this real old-school history teacher. One day we got into class and she said, "Today we're going to see a movie about isms." And we saw this movie that was the equivalent of Reefer Madness, about communism and socialism. Of course, there was nothing about individualism or capitalism. It was just about socialism and communism. It was like a melodrama with a vile-looking guy who was selling bottles of poison. But instead of having X on them for poison, it said socialism or communism. So a lot of that, even in Berkeley, was still being drilled into the students at that time. Nonetheless, history was one of my favorite subjects. Getting free of religion. About that time, I was becoming an atheist. Ironically, one of the influences that convinced me not to believe in God was Freud, who actually put forward and reinforced some reactionary notions, including in regard to women, but whose critique of religion I found compelling. He tied religion in with the tradition of the powerful father figure, and that influenced me to recognize that religion was a human invention and a human device. At that time, most of my friends were still religious, and in fact, the four of us who hung together all the time, me, Matthew, Hemby, and Joel, all still nominally went to the same church. Mainly, that was because we were playing on the church league basketball team together, and so we sort of had to put in our time in order to legitimately represent the church. Also, I was still living with my parents, still under their aegis, so to speak, and they wanted me to go to church, and I still went, even after I started not believing, which was obviously a source of tension. But the intellectual ferment, getting into philosophy, starting to study history as well as literature and so on, led me to see from a lot of different directions that religion and the idea of God were human inventions. All these different cultures had different ideas of God that conflicted with and contradicted each other. We studied Greek mythology with Ms. Bentley, and you could see that different people in different ages believed in all different kinds of gods, and that some of these had passed out of convention and weren't widely believed in anymore. To tell the truth, losing my religion was more emancipating than upsetting. I talked earlier about how when I was a kid I used to tempt God by saying, "Fuck," and then wondering if God would punish me, and if I should atone for my sins and pray for forgiveness. I know some people say that faith in God gives them a system of belief to live by and to do good things in the world. Even some very progressive people say this. But I found belief in God to be very intimidating, very oppressive and repressive. The Christian religion is full of fear, as is Islam, over what's going to happen to you if you somehow displease God. So while there may have been a time when giving up that set of fairly strong beliefs that I'd been raised with shook me up, I increasingly found it emancipating to throw that off, to more look at the world the way it is, and to not have that feeling that something was going to happen to you if you said, "fuck," or in one way or another, displeased God. I still believe that there was right and wrong. I don't know exactly what I thought it was rooted in, but I just believed that certain things were right and certain things were wrong. Racism was wrong, for instance. You didn't need religion to tell you what was right and wrong, and you didn't need the fear of God to make you do what was right. There were just some things that were right and some things that were wrong, and you acted accordingly. That might have been somewhat naive, and obviously it's not deeply enough rooted to carry you a long, long way, but at that time it was very emancipating for me. I just didn't feel the need for God. My parents were aware of this, especially once I got out of high school and became more intellectually emancipated, as well as practically emancipated in a lot of ways. I just started voicing my view more, and this was the source of a lot of conflict and tension, and we got into big arguments about it. As for my friends, today there's all this nonsense about how black people are just inherently religious, and that's a whole thing that gets me pissed off. It's just bullshit. These are socially conditioned things. A lot of my black friends and a lot of people who influenced me later in life, like the Panthers, were going through the same thing I'd gone through and recognized that these religious ideas and institutions are human inventions and not very good ones. So some of my friends were still religious, but many of them were going through the same general kind of emancipating experience that I was in casting off religion. Anne Frank. I was in the senior play in high school, The Diary of Anne Frank. I played Peter van Damme, and Frank's boyfriend. I never sat down and memorized my lines. I just went to rehearsal all the time, and by the time the play was actually put on, I knew everybody's lines from beginning to end, without ever studying any of them. If you'd plug me in anywhere in the play and give me the first word, I could just go forward from there through the whole play. But I don't think the full heaviness of that story really hit me until a few years later. Obviously, I understood it on a certain level. And even though this was just a senior play in high school, I actually did try to get inside of the play and understand my character and the other characters as well, and really give some expression to it. But still, I was a 17-year-old kid. I hadn't lived through an experience like that. I knew about the Holocaust, but I didn't really have a deep understanding of it. I got that later, when I went to college and I had more Jewish friends and learned about it more. It wasn't just that I had never experienced anything like that, but I'd also never had relationships with people whose family had gone through that, or who knew people very closely who'd gone through that. That happened a little bit later. So although at the time of this senior play in high school, I knew about the Holocaust, and I was somewhat familiar with the very gripping story of Anne Frank, as I grew and developed, my understanding of it got deepened. Football. Playing on the high school football team was very important to me in a lot of ways. I spoke earlier about how the integrated setting of the team ended up teaching me more than any class that I had. But it was also just important to me as football. And on the level of football itself, in my senior year, things didn't go so well. We usually had a really good team, but that year I think we only won 4 out of the 9 games we played, so that was kind of frustrating. People kept getting injured, people were quitting the team, and the coach was using all these old-fashioned formations, which weren't really working, so he kept shifting them. From week to week, everybody had to learn new assignments, which was part of why we didn't have such a successful season. Still, even though we were losing games, it was a lot of fun. We traveled 50 miles to play against a school in Stockton in my junior year, for instance. The socializing was a lot of fun in general, and there would be some occasions like that Vallejo game with the bus ride where we had that deep talk about racism and discrimination, and we ended up winning that game, and I had a good game that night. So that particular experience was a very positive one. There were other, more frustrating experiences, but overall, I have very positive and fond remembrances of this whole experience. Interestingly, when I went to college at Berkeley and I was starting to practice for the freshman football team, I already started to get the sense that in college it was going to be much more of a serious affair, like a business, and not nearly so much fun as in high school. In high school, whether we won or lost, we had a lot of fun. You lost a game on Friday, and on Monday you'd be back at practice with your friends, and you'd get ready for the next game. If you had a good game, you'd get written up in the paper for having a good game. And if you had a bad game, you had to put up with being written about for having a lousy game. But it was all part of the fun. At the same time, there's a lot of militarism, a lot of macho, a lot of downright misogynistic shit that goes along with sports in this society, that whole dominant sports culture. And that could have had a very negative influence overall if it weren't for the larger things happening in society, and in particular the whole thing breaking loose around black people, which mainly made this a positive experience and a positive influence on me, even though a contradictory one. I played quarterback, and when you're sort of leading a team that's not doing that well, it can be a pretty mixed experience. But I had always been encouraged to play sports by my parents, with my father directly teaching me how to do things, and my mother more generally being very supportive. So I had a lot of confidence. I wasn't intimidated by being quarterback, but I also didn't really think of it that much as being a leader. I just thought of it as a position I want to play, largely because I love to pass in football, and I developed a pretty good ability to pass. I remember one game when I was playing on the junior varsity, we came from behind to tie the game, and I completed 5 or 6 passes in a row, and then we scored a touchdown, and that felt really good. But I never thought of myself as the field general. I just thought, okay, I'll call the plays, and I sort of led the team in a general sense. But more was that I liked this position because I loved to pass the ball. I thought that passing, if you could really do it well, was a beautiful art. That's the way I looked at it. I also loved track, and our school always had really good track teams. In my younger sister's class, there was a guy named Jerry Williams, who was a great sprinter. He broke all kinds of records and had a beautiful running style. My friend Matthew was on the track team as well as the football team, and he won the state meet one year in the shot put. Later on, he didn't like his college shot put coach, so he asked me to coach him. I didn't really know that much about it, so I had to go read up on it. Anyway, I really love track and basketball, and I went to almost every one of our school's basketball games and almost all the track meets. During my senior year, there was a league track meet leading toward the state championship meet. I really wanted to go to this track meet, but it started at something like 2 p.m. on a school day and was an hour drive away. I was able to get my parents' car for that day. Of course, I didn't tell them what my plan was. I don't like to come into sporting events after they start. I wanted to see the meet from the very beginning. But it started at 2, and I didn't get out of school until 3, and if I left then, it would be almost 4 o'clock, and I'd miss more than half the meet. So I devised a plan where I got a friend of mine, who had a very deep bass voice, to call up the school attendance office during lunch break and pretend to be my father. "This is Spurgeon of Aitken. I'll be coming in today at 1 to pick up my son to take him to a dentist's appointment." So I was sitting in my Spanish class, and they sent me a note saying, "You're supposed to meet your father outside at 1 to go to a dentist appointment." Of course, I went out and got in the car and drove to the track meet. A vice principal in the school, who was also an assistant coach on the football team, saw me at the track meet early. But since he sort of liked me and knew me from the football team, he just came up to me a few days later and asked, "Wasn't that you at the track meet about 2:15? I said, "Are you sure you saw me there?" And he just kind of let it slide. But then a couple of days later, the attendance office called me in, and they asked me, "What's this about how you were supposed to go to a dental appointment, and instead you showed up at the track meet?" I don't know if it was this vice principal or someone else who told. But I said, "Well, it's not my fault. You sent me a note saying I was supposed to meet my father to go to the dentist." I think I got away with it mainly because I was a good student. After the football season in my sophomore year, I went out for basketball. And the coach tried to tell me that I was too short to play on the basketball team. So I just walked off. I played with a lot of the guys on the team at the playgrounds, so I knew I could play with him. I knew I was good enough to be on the squad. But I just got pissed off when he told me I was too short. Then, a couple of years later, the basketball coach was my gym teacher, and we used to play basketball in gym class. Finally, one day he comes up to me and he says, "How come you never came out for the basketball team?" I just looked at him. And then I told him, "'Cause you said I was too short." He just got a funny look and walked away. I guess he'd forgotten. Keeping the rep. I still prided myself on my reputation as a teacher's trial. For example, I always tried to get my homework done in study hall, partly because I didn't want to be burdened with homework, and partly because I was trying to cultivate this reputation of someone who's both a wild kind of guy, but also a surprisingly good student who never had to study. Part of that whole image was never carrying books home after school. So I really worked hard in study class, and only rarely did I take books home to study, only if I had to write a paper or maybe study for a test. But sometimes I'd get bored in study class, and I'd think up antics and pranks. There was a teacher in one study class who was this nasty disciplinarian, and everybody hated her. Now, if you were in study class and had to do a makeup test or something, you could be excused from the study class to go do it. So I had a friend of mine write a note saying that I had to go take a Spanish test during the study class, and my friend signed the note with the name of my Spanish teacher. I then walked up to the study class teacher, whom everybody hated, and presented to her this note. She countersigned it, at which point I tore it up and threw it in the wastebasket. I said, "I just wanted to see if I could fool you." She got so furious that she took the note out of the waste paper basket and meticulously scotch-taped it back together and then sent it down to the vice principal in charge of discipline for students. So I got called into the vice principal's office the next day, and my defense was, "Look, I was just having fun. I didn't actually cut study class. I was just trying to see if I could actually fool her, and once I fooled her, I just tore the note up and threw it away. You can see she had to put it back together, so I wasn't really trying to cut class." Once again, I got away with it because I was a good student, and let's face it, also because I came from a good home and good family. I also had a physics class as a sophomore, and I think the teacher's name was Mr. Nelson. He was a lively teacher and a pretty good teacher, But he also had this strict thing about no talking out of order in class. You were not allowed to talk unless you were called on by Mr. Nelson himself. This is a rule I found very hard to go along with. He would take points off every time you spoke out of turn in class, and that would take away from your grade average. Even knowing that, there were times when I couldn't resist. One time he was talking about measurements in physics, one named after Isaac Newton, called the Newton, and the other called the Dyne. He asked, "Does anybody know what the equivalency is between Newtons and Dynes?" I wasn't sure I'd get called on, so without raising my hand, I just spoke up and said, "I think down at the corner store you can get 2 Fig Newtons for a dime." Mr. Nelson said, "Very funny," and then docked me 10 points. But to me, a good pun is worth 10 points any time. Wild times and hairy situations. My love for basketball and music sometimes drew me into some wild situations. My first semester in Berkeley High, our school won our league and therefore qualified to go to the Tournament of Champions, TOC. We ended up losing in the final to McClyman's. It was a good game, but they had a better team. This was bitterly disappointing to me, as I was all excited about how we were going to win the TOC. But even before our game on the first day of the TOC, I went with a couple of friends who'd come up to Berkeley High from Garfield Junior High with me, Jim, who was sort of a prankster, and Phil, who was one of the tough kids at Garfield. We were sitting in the front row, right under one basket, and Pauley High was playing, a school from the Fillmore ghetto of San Francisco. They had a good team, but they were behind at halftime. The Fillmore district of San Francisco has since been gentrified, and thousands of black people who live there have been driven out through this process. Pauley High no longer exists. Pauley High had this really good player named John Lewis, and we were watching him all during the game. He had a real bad act on the court, though it probably wasn't just an act. Every time he'd line up on the free throw line, he would intimidate everybody around him. At the end of the first half in this game, when Pauley High was still behind, the ball rolled off the court and right to where we were sitting. There were only a few seconds left until halftime, and the ball rolls right to me. John Lewis comes running up. He's trying to get the ball in play so they can score before halftime. And he says to me, "Give me the ball, man! Give me the ball, man!" So I pick up the ball and I try to hand it back to him. But Jim sticks his hand underneath the ball where you can't see it. And when I try to give it to John Lewis, Jim pulls the ball back. So Lewis thinks I'm playing a trick on him. Then the buzzer sounds and John Lewis looks at me with this really penetrating glare and goes, "Aw, shit, man." Then, fortunately, his team went off the court, and he turned and ran off with them. But Jim and Phil both said, "I'm getting the fuck out of here," and they went and sat way, way up high in the gym, as far away from the court as they could get. But I love basketball and the whole scene by the court too much to just move away like that. When John Lewis was maybe a senior in high school or just out of high school, he was arrested for pulling an armed robbery of a store in San Francisco. The reason they were able to arrest him was that during the robbery, he pulled out his gun and said to the store owner, "Give me all your money! Give me all your money!" And the guy apparently was taking too long. So finally, John Lewis says to him, "Hurry up, man! Hurry up! Don't you know who I am? I'm John Lewis! I'm all TOC!" Just after I graduated from high school, a carload of me and my friends, many of whom were still in high school, went down to see Oakland City College play against San Francisco City College. This guy, Charles, who had gone to our high school, was playing for San Francisco City College, and they won the game. Afterward, he was standing in the doorway leading down to the locker room and bragging about how he had held down this player named Howard Foster, who had played for McClyman's and was now playing for Oakland City College. He was bragging about how Howard Foster ain't shit. I held him to 8 points. He ain't shit, and all this kind of stuff. Suddenly, this guy who ran track for Oakland City College stepped out of the crowd and said to Charles, who was still bragging, "You ain't shit either." And boom, he hit him. Charles was standing against the wall, and he was knocked out on his feet. He went sliding down the wall. Then, of course, the whole place was ready to go up. And all of my friends were saying, "We gotta get out of here, man. We gotta get out of here." But I'm saying, "Oh, let's wait and see what happens." And they were coming back with, "Are you crazy? Let's get out of here. Let's get out of here now." Of course, they understood the potential there for big trouble much better than I did. So they were trying to get me out of there, and on our way out, we passed this woman that I'd always seen at McClyman's games at the TOC. She was maybe in her 30s or early 40s, and she always wore this McClyman sweater. She had it on that time, and as we walked by, someone turned to her and said, "Aren't you a little worried about what's going to happen here?" She opened her purse and said, "No, I'm not worried, because I always got my friend with me," and pointed to her gun. Then all my friends were saying, "Man, we really got to get out of here now." And they finally succeeded in prevailing on me to get us out of there. Another time, Joel, Matthew, Hemby, and I had been hanging out on a Saturday night. There was this place called Bobo's, a hamburger joint in West Berkeley, and we decided we wanted to get a hamburger. So we pulled into Bobo's, and as we came up to make our order, we see there's this crowd gathered around. There's this real buffed-up, bulky white guy holding a bench. And there's this other guy I knew from high school named Wazell with a knife. And the two of them are in a standoff, going back and forth and threatening each other. Finally, Wazell's girlfriend. This was a ritual that I'd seen Wazell do. He kind of allowed his girlfriend to talk him out of a fight. His girlfriend says, "Come on, Wazell, come on, Wazell, let's go, let's go." They start heading toward their car, and all of a sudden this white guy, who's been holding the bench, feels emboldened and says, "Yeah, next time, motherfucker, you pull a knife on me, I'll wrap this bench around your head." So Wazell says, "Oh yeah, motherfucker, oh yeah?" And he comes out of his car with a paper bag and pulls out the biggest knife that I'd ever seen out of that bag. And everybody, including the guy with the bench, takes off running, saying, "Hey, they called the cops, they called the cops." Because naturally the people working at Bobo's saw something had to be done about this. So everybody left, but the four of us. We calmly went and put in our order and got it. And we were sitting in our car with our hamburgers and shakes when the cops pulled up. We're the only people left in the parking lot. And so a cop comes up, knocks on my window, and I open it a little bit and say, "Yeah?" He says, "I heard there was some kind of a fight around here." I just kind of shrug my shoulders. So he says, "Do you know anything about it?" "Nah." He goes on, "And I suppose you don't know who was involved or what happened, huh?" And I said, "Nah," again. So he turned to the others in the car and said, "What about the rest of you?" "Nah." Then he got all pissed off and drove away. My friends and I, we wanted our hamburgers, and this wasn't a big thing to us. Wazell was just this kind of character, always getting into this kind of shit. On the other hand, we weren't going to cooperate with these cops either. Another time, Matthew and I went to the Oakland Auditorium to see a concert with James Brown and the Famous Flames, the Drifters, and I think maybe Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. It was a big show. But it wasn't just a concert, it was also a dance. So part of the floor was cleared, and people would stand and also would dance, even before the acts came on. They played music before the show started and in between the sets. The scene was already a little bit tense, because you had all these rivalries with people from different schools and different cliques and everything, all there in this auditorium. Since Matthew was from Oakland, he knew a lot of people there, and he was going around talking to them. Then he and I went and sat down. For a while during the evening, when the acts would come on and people were dancing, fights would break out. Then they'd cool it out, the fights would stop, and the acts would start up again. And then the same thing would happen. This happened two or three times, and finally Matthew said, "Man, I don't want to get caught up in all this. Let's go upstairs." Because there was a balcony, and we could see the whole thing from up there. So we were sitting in the balcony, and again one of these acts started up, and now this really big fight broke out, much bigger than any of the previous fights. People were fighting all over the floor, and all of a sudden the main door into the auditorium flies open, and this phalanx of Oakland cops, who were known to be particularly brutal and racist, comes in, pulling out their clubs and swinging on people. And from where we were sitting in the balcony, we could see all the people down on the floor just rotate and form a kind of phalanx of their own to fight the cops. It was some of the most beautiful choreography I've ever seen. They stopped fighting each other, swung around 90 degrees, got into formation, and started fighting the cops. This was all spontaneous. There was no plan or leadership, but it was very impressive. He walks in the classroom, cool and slow. I mentioned earlier the Pendleton shirt that was considered really cool when I was in junior high, and how I saved up and paid for part of that. I also saved up and bought myself a cashmere sweater when I was 13, because for whatever reason, that was considered to be the height of cool in the crowd that I was in at that time. But when I got to high school, again things changed for all the reasons I've been talking about, and my sense of cool changed completely as well. I have to confess that one of the things I prided myself on was what was then called the Mac, which was how cool you walked. Of course, you can see the contradictory nature of it, because Mac is another word for pimp, and this was sort of imitating the supposedly cool walk of the pimp. Now, the guys who were into this, most of them didn't really have any interest in being a pimp, but how slowly you walked and how you moved your body when you walked was a barometer of cool. And I used to really pride myself on having a really good Mac. When I was a senior, I worked in this school office where I would sometimes take messages to different classrooms. And there was one math class in particular where the math teacher was a kind of a wild, crazy guy anyway. So I was coming to deliver this message to his class, and I just happened to walk in through the back door. When I opened the back door, everyone looked up to see what was happening. And I think I literally took 40 seconds to walk the 40 feet to the front of the room to deliver the message. The whole class started cracking up because I was really putting on my Mac. After that, there were a number of times during that semester when I would have messages for that class. And every time I would open the back door, all the students would look up. And as soon as they saw me, they would begin clapping their hands and snapping their fingers rhythmically. Even the teacher would join in sometimes. This became sort of an institution. It happened maybe 10 times during this class. And I could always tell that the students in the class were glad when I opened the back door and they saw it was me, because they knew there was going to be a diversion, a little entertainment, a break in the routine. Then when I was a senior in high school, we had an award assembly. A number of us on the football team decided informally to have a contest to see who could have the baddest Mac walking up to get our football letter. And as part of that, who could take the longest from the time their name was called until the time they actually were handed their award. So that was the kind of thing that was a matter of style and cool, even though it obviously had a negative aspect, the whole thing associated with the Mac. But it was a much broader phenomenon. You didn't think of yourself as a pimp. You just thought it was cool. A little guy, brimming with confidence. I would say I graduated from high school at a very optimistic time. A lot of things were changing. There were a lot of challenges, but there was a feel in the air that things could change for the better. A lot of black people, a lot of people like those who went to the anti-HUAC demonstration, a lot of people generally felt a certain optimism. And the fact that I came from the kind of family and the kind of middle-class background that I did, that can give you a certain sense of confidence too, frankly. But even for people who weren't white or middle-class, there was in the air a feeling of a positive wind blowing, an optimism about social change for the better and getting out of years and centuries of oppression. All that was part of the swirl of the times, if you want to put it that way. That was how I felt about things, and about myself. I remember even though our football team didn't do very well, I felt good about playing football. My younger sister, Mary Lou, used to always kid me because at one time this local sports reporter wrote an article that featured me, and at one point he referred to me as Bobby, a little guy, but brimming with confidence. That was a phrase that was in this article. Mary Lou had a friend who read this article, and every time she'd see my sister, she would repeat that phrase, Bobby, a little guy, but brimming with confidence. So my sister would kid me about this, but this did sort of capture something about me personally, but also how I felt about the time. There was also, from sports and a lot of the influences on me, this whole bearing I had of being kind of bad. And speaking of my younger sister, there was this guy, Buddy, whom she went out with in high school and later married. But my first encounter with Buddy was when I was a senior in high school and he was a sophomore. Some of my friends and I were driving around in Oakland looking for something to do on a Saturday night, stopping at different friends' houses and asking if anything were going on. And finally, somebody said they knew something about a party in East Oakland. Even though Buddy lived in Berkeley, he had some relatives in East Oakland with a bigger house, so he was having a party out there. Of course, I didn't know him at this time. But we got out of our car and went walking up to the door, rang the doorbell, and when Buddy opened the door, we could tell there were all these people inside. The place was packed. We said we had come for the party. Buddy looked at us and said, I'm really sorry, but I just can't let anybody else in. So we were pissed off, It was getting late, and we'd driven all the way out there to East Oakland to go to this party. As Buddy was going back into the house, I turned to my friends and I said, "Let's turn this punk out." And they all said to me, No, man, calm down. Come on, we can't do that. Look at the house, man. It's full of people. You can't blame him. Come on, cool out." So that's what prevailed. We just went on and did something else. But part of the whole culture that I'd taken up as my own was that you had to be cool and you had to be kind of bad. Later, Buddy and I laughed about this when I told him this story. He remembered the incident in a general way, but once we became really close and became family, then it had a whole different meaning, obviously, and we laughed about it. Later on, after they were married for a few years, my sister and Buddy broke up. But even though that was painful, she remained fond of him, and I liked him a lot too. By then, Buddy was a revolutionary-minded guy. A number of his relatives were among the first members of the Black Panther Party. But Buddy, tragically, died in a car accident not too long after he and my sister broke up. At the time I graduated from high school, I didn't have any clear idea what I wanted to do with the rest of my life in the big sense. But I definitely knew what I was going to do next. I was going to go to Cal and play football. I was interested in English literature and history and politics, so I was going to major in one of those, or some combination of those, or maybe I'd end up in law, or maybe not. I didn't know. Maybe I was going to end up being a lawyer. Maybe I was going to write poetry. Maybe I was going to... I didn't know what I was going to do for sure, but I knew I was going to Cal. The truck barn and the office. I graduated from Berkeley High in January 1961, and my parents suggested that I work for the 8 months or so until September and then start college. Coming from this middle-class professional family, we had enough money that I didn't have to work, but they thought it would be good experience for me to do some work, and I could save some money, so I got two part-time jobs. One was working in an office in the morning, and in the afternoon and evening, I worked in a truck barn where the trucking companies leave their trucks at the end of the day. I had to make sure the trucks had enough gas, that the motors were oiled, that what they called the fifth wheel, which connects to the trailer, was greased so everything would fit together right, and things related to that. That was my job in the afternoon and evening. I could come in during the afternoon whenever I wanted, more or less, and work in the evening until I finished. I just had to get the job done. And at the end of the week, I could work either Friday or come in Saturday morning, because they didn't run on the weekends, so I just had to get the trucks ready for Monday. The office job was the first time I'd worked in that kind of situation, and the people were very narrow and petty. But interestingly enough, I went back and worked there for a little while about 4 years later, when the Vietnam War and the protests against it were beginning to become really big, and some of the people working there had really broadened their outlook. I even saw some of them at these anti-war demonstrations, people you could never have imagined being at something like that 4 years earlier. I worked at those jobs right up until the end of August in 1961, and it was a very good mix and a very good experience, working two different jobs with two very different situations and kinds of people. One day at the truck barn, for example, a tanker truck came in to fill up the underground tank with gas for the gas pumps at the truck barn. The guy put the hose down into the tank, and then he went off into the office to do something. But he hadn't put the hose in very well, and so the hose started slipping out of the tank in the ground, and gasoline was spraying everywhere. Like a fool, because I wasn't very experienced, I went running up to try to grab the hose and shove it back in. And of course I got this geyser, this torrent of gas, shooting into my face and into my eyes. Not only did it sting, but I was temporarily blinded. And even more upsetting, I wasn't sure if the blinding was only temporary. So I went running into the area where the mechanics worked, screaming to a mechanic, an older guy who had worked many years as a mechanic. I quickly told him what had happened and desperately asked him, "Am I going to be blind? Am I going to be blind?" He said, No, don't worry about it. Just run some water and wash it out." And I said, "Has this ever happened to you?" He laughed. "It's happened to me a dozen times." Those kinds of experiences were new for me and taught me a lot. Even though I was working these two part-time jobs, I still tried to have my social life. After I finished work in the truck barn, I would go hang out with my friends. One night I had arranged with my friend Hemby to go to a party after work, but he'd forgotten about it and fallen asleep. So when I came over about 11 o'clock at night and knocked on the window of his bedroom, he woke up, not knowing what the hell was going on. And he said, "Yeah, who is it?" I said, "It's me." "Who's me?" "It's me, Hemby, it's me." Then he says, "Well, listen, me, I got something for your ass." So then I had to quickly explain to him who it was and remind him we were going to a party, which we then did. But it was a little nerve-wracking there for a second. I still love the TOC, but now I had a problem because the TOC ran from Thursday through Saturday. Thursday it started at 4:30, and Friday it started at 4:30, and the last game started at 9, so the schedule conflicted with my work. What was I going to do? Somebody got me a pass to the TOC that let me go in and out every time I wanted to, without having to pay each time. So that took care of part of the problem. Then I schemed to get to the games and miss as little as possible. McClymans was playing in the first game on Thursday, and I really wanted to see that game. And in the 9 o'clock game, Richmond High was playing, and I really wanted to see that game too. So I figured, okay, I could miss the other two games on Thursday if I had to. I showed up at the TOC on Thursday at my customary time, about 5 minutes after 4 when they opened the doors. I strategically parked my car and watched the McClymans game, which ended a little before 6. Then I went sprinting out, got in my car, I won't say how fast I drove, but I drove the 5 or 6 miles to my job as fast as I could, went ripping through the job at the truck barn, finished up about 8:40, got back in my car, went ripping back up to the gym, again, I won't say how fast I went, parked the car, got my pass out, ran in and got there just in time for the tip-off of the Richmond game. Then Friday, it wasn't a problem because I could put the work off until Saturday morning. So I went to all the games on Friday. I only missed 2 games that year. Everybody was waiting to see Richmond and McClymans play in the final of the TOC that year. In the first game of the year that season, Richmond had broken McClymans' 68-game winning streak. But McClymans hadn't lost another game all year, and they'd won the TOC 5 years in a row. Richmond and McClymans were in separate brackets in the TOC, so they were supposed to meet in the final. Richmond had this great player named Leroy Walker, who later played for the Globetrotters. He's the one who really made the difference in beating McClymans earlier in the season. But when they got to the TOC, for some reason he had an off game. I think he only made 5 out of 23 shots that day, and Richmond lost unexpectedly. So McClymans and Richmond didn't have a rematch. But nevertheless, there were a number of great games, including the final, which McClymans won once again. All the effort I went through that year to see as much of the TOC as I could was definitely worth it. Camping in Yosemite, and then. My friend Matthew graduated from high school before me, and he'd gone off to the University of Illinois on a football scholarship. He only stayed there 1 year before he got disgusted by the racism in the school and in the football program, so he came back to go to Cal. But he was gone much of that year, 1961. A couple of weeks before school started in the fall that year, I quit the 2 part-time jobs. But before I started college, some friends of mine and I, including Matthew, who was home for the summer, decided to go for a camping trip to Yosemite. I borrowed my family's car, and the 4 of us went up to Yosemite. We were having a great time, but then something happened that changed all that. Matthew wanted to learn how to drive, but his father was kind of a tyrannical patriarch who always liked to have something over him. We'd go to a movie and Matthew would have to borrow some money from his dad, and his dad would basically make him beg for the money, even though his dad had a relatively good job as a longshoreman and could afford a few dollars for a movie. As part of this whole Lord of the House bullshit, he wouldn't let Matthew get a driver's license. So Matthew was always after me, even though he didn't have a driver's license, to let him learn how to drive by driving the car that I had. But the car that I had at that point was my parents' car, so that made me especially reluctant. We got up in Yosemite and he kept after me, "Let me drive, let me drive, let me drive." I held out and held out and held out. But finally one day, we decided the 2 of us would hike up this mountain in Yosemite, and the other friend, who did have a driver's license and was an experienced driver, would go with Matthew, and Matthew would drive the car. Not just on the flat. I don't know what we were thinking, but up this winding mountain road. So the two of us hiked up to the top, and we expected to find the other two up there waiting for us, because obviously you could drive up faster than you could hike it. But they weren't there. We looked all over the parking lot. We looked and we looked and we looked. And all of a sudden this car pulled up. I still remember it had Alabama license plates. It struck me as an irony because they were these white people from Alabama, and the driver said to us, "You have a friend named Matthew?" My heart just sank right down to my knees, and I answered, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, they've had an accident, and they're okay, but the car looks like it's totaled." We got a ride down to the site of the accident, and luckily Matthew and the other guy had only really minor injuries, basically just scrapes and bruises. But when I looked at the scene of the accident, they could easily have been killed. They'd gone off a mountain road on a turn. They'd sailed over a pile of rocks between two trees and landed on an upside-down fallen tree, which acted as a brake and brought them to a stop, nudged right up against another giant tree. And even though they escaped serious injury, it was obvious that the two of them could have been killed. These were friends of mine, and Matthew was one of my very closest friends. Of course, I felt terrible. I felt responsible, and then I had to call my parents and tell them that their car had been totaled. They were away somewhere and got a third-hand garbled message, so they thought that I'd been in an accident. When they found out what had actually happened, they were relieved that I hadn't been in an accident and that nobody had been badly hurt or killed. But of course they were angry about my really bad judgment in letting Matthew drive the car. And I felt responsible, not only for their car being wrecked, but for allowing a situation in which he and the other guy could have been killed. So this put a negative shadow over the end of that vacation. But then I was getting ready to go to Cal, so I turned my thoughts toward that. I'd always wanted to go to Cal ever since I was a kid growing up in Berkeley. I knew Cal was a good school academically, and I was interested in the academics. But it also had always been a dream of mine to play football at Cal. I was looking forward to playing on the freshman football team, even though I knew I could never be a starter. It turned out that the quarterback in my freshman class was a guy named Craig Morton, who ended up playing for many years in the NFL. But I still wanted to be on the team, and at least maybe get a chance to play. So it was both things, academics and sports. I was also excited about all the intellectual and artistic ferment going on. In my senior year in high school, we used to go to jazz clubs. And then at the end of the night, we might stay up all night talking. I can remember arguing one time with people, late into the night, about the writings of St. Augustine, for example. They had a room in the library at Cal where, even if you weren't a student at the university, you could sit and listen to different recordings. There was a recording of Allen Ginsberg reading his poem, Howl, and I used to put those headphones on and go into a whole different world, listening to this hypnotic recording. I remember the poem's indictment of American society as Moloch, which spoke to feelings of alienation I was beginning to experience. It moved me in a way that a political manifesto would not have at that time. Moloch, whose mind is pure machinery. Moloch, whose blood is running money. Moloch, whose fingers are 10 armies. Moloch, whose breast is a cannibal dynamo. Moloch, whose ear is a smoking tomb. The opening line of that poem also made a deep impression on me. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. I couldn't wait to get started at Cal.